Is there a future for coal mining in Illinois?
I mean, when our mine closed, they still had a good 30, 40 years of coal sitting there. So, you know, it's just sad. These are not low-paying jobs. These are good union jobs that they've closed down.
We'll speak to miners from central and southern Illinois about the impact the changing industries had on their families and communities, and talk to Chicago Tribune reporter John Kyleman, who's been reporting on the future of the coal industry. Plus, why did a group of window washers dress up as superheroes for work? We'll hear the story of their visit to a children's hospital in Chicago. And we'll be joined in studio by two members of the freshly united indie band Poster Children. They're back to celebrate the 25th anniversary of their album Daisy Chain Reaction and perform at the Pygmalion Festival this weekend in Champaign. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. It's Friday, September 23rd. I'm Nyla Boodoo. All this week, we've been talking about different kinds of economic opportunity in Illinois. It's part of a national NPR project we're taking in called A Nation Engage. Maybe you've heard some of the stories about economic opportunity on Morning Edition and All Things Considered. We've been talking about the cost of college education, what manufacturing looks like now compared to what it used to be, especially given Illinois' current fiscal climate. Next week, we're going to be looking at how much income inequality has grown across Illinois over the past year. Today, we're focusing on the coal industry with an eye especially to southern Illinois. The numbers employed in the coal industry of people working have been dropping all year to just about 3,000. Many of those cuts have come as Illinois companies react to stricter environmental laws and more reliance on cleaner natural gas. In a few minutes, we're going to be speaking with Chicago Tribune reporter John Kyleman. He's been spending some time in southern Illinois reporting on how much this presidential election will further affect the coal industry's future in Illinois. But we wanted to start with a retired miner from Baldwin. Randy Phelps is president of Local 1149 of the United Mine Workers Association of America. Baldwin's about 40 miles southeast of St. Louis. Hi, Randy. Welcome to the 21st. Thanks for talking with us.
Yes, glad to.
Now, you worked for Peabody Coal in southern Illinois from 1966 until the mid-90s. That's when you got an injury and you had to go on disability. I wonder, how are things different for miners now when they were back when you were still in the industry?
Well, most of the difference now is that there's just not too many coal mines in operation. Peabody Coal, we don't have there's not a union mine left in Illinois anywhere that Peabody's got. They've got a couple of non-union operations going on, but that's about all they got left as far as in coal production. Most of their mining nowadays is done out west.
Randy, how have you seen communities in southern Illinois been impacted by the loss of jobs, by coal mining communities shutting down? It's a very different picture now than it was from when you were there. What's it like in your town?
Well, it's just like everything else has ever been, like the auto industry out in Ohio and whatever. You shut down your major money supply, the coal industry in Illinois was either tops or first. And the farmers and the coal industry is the two biggest industries it was in southern Illinois and all of Illinois. And the coal industry is just, the bottom has completely dropped out of it. So all the towns, little small towns around, have all been affected by drops in stores closing and banks are closing and all such things. The towns, some of them are just kind of like ghost towns because that's all they depended on around was the coal industry. And it's been quite devastating to not only people who work at the mine, but the towns around. Because for every coal miner that was laid off, there's a good 10 to 15 people that's been affected with that margin because the coal industry is not around. And we sure wish our problem is that I have and a lot of others that we know and that the coal, as far as pollution-wise, could be cleaned up. It would just take the operators and the government to work together a little bit and come up with a technique to clean this coal up to where they could burn it. And not have no problem with it. When they can take sewage water and clean it back to drinkable water, they can surely take a little sulfur out of some coal and get it to where it's operating. But it's all down what it amounts to is the dollar for the companies, and it's cheaper for them to be turned into natural gas than it is to fight the cleaning up of the coal. So But the other towns are devastated around here.
Randy, I think about that when you say that the towns are devastated. I can't imagine what that must look like. And I wonder, do you see any other companies? Are there other industries you feel like that are moving into the area? Where do you think that businesses, are there businesses that are growing at all?
No. No, that's the problem. Like I say, we got a little town down here next to us, Marissa, where the coal mine's around. There's 150 houses in sale in that town. And it's a big disadvantage when there's just no money coming in or no industry whatsoever. And they're just, it just seems big that no other business wants to, you know, pull into these small communities, which all the coal mines were at, were normally around smaller communities. So,
Randy, you know, sorry, what were you said 150,000. Sorry, what were you saying there?
I said there's 150 homes for sale in a little town called Marissa. Just, and that's just a small town. there's nobody moving in. Nobody can buy anything. Like I said, they're down to one bank. They used to have three banks, and it's just one of them things that the money situation has really dropped down. And our problem with the coal mines is that there's nothing else for these guys to get to do, and most of them got quite a bit of age on them. And their spouses and all, it's really a hard thing to even think about losing their health care and pensions. And that's what the situation we're in.
Well, thank you for taking the time to join us. Randy Phelps, joining us from Baldwin in Southern Illinois, where he's a retired miner, president of Local 1148, United Mine Workers of America. Thanks for being with us.
All righty. Thank you very much for the interview.
We're joined now by John Kileman. He's a reporter for the Chicago Tribune, whose article earlier this week was exploring the impact the future president is likely to have on Illinois' coal industry. Hey, John, thanks for being with us. Welcome to the 21st.
Thank you very much.
When we think about the past year, you wrote about originally we're looking at more than 1,200 mines lost, and we're thinking about the jobs that have been cut. There's about 2,800 mining jobs. What's been driving those cuts?
Well, a couple things. Primarily, it has been the power generating industry and utilities moving to natural gas because it is a cheaper source of energy for them because of all the natural gas that has been produced through fracking. And secondly, it is a series of EPA rules that the Obama administration has put through or would like to put through that are designed to reduce coal pollution. So a lot of utilities are just are getting out in front of that by switching to natural gas, and therefore, should these regulations, the one in particular is called the Clean Power Plan, should that one go through, it's going to make it even tougher to be a coal-burning power plant in America. So a lot of them are just switching out to natural gas in advance of that.
And I know when you've spoken to different environmental groups, I'm thinking of, I know you talked to Howard Lerner from the Environmental Law and Policy Center in Chicago. He's arguing it's not regulation, but also what he says bad business decisions that have led to coal's decline. What does he mean by that?
Well, some of the very largest coal companies in recent years, there was a spike in demand, mostly coming from overseas, and China in particular, with their industry, just growing in leaps and bounds. And as a result of that, companies like Peabody bought a lot of new mines to try and cash in on it, essentially. And right as they did that, the Chinese economy started to cool down, and the Chinese government got more serious about moving away from coal as a power source. So the demand slipped there, and the debt they were holding was not sustainable with the money they were making. And so a lot of them declared bankruptcy.
Joan, I wonder if you could also help us understand a little bit more of the history of coal mining in Illinois. I think this is such a part of the state's history, and we look at numbers like in the 90s when Randy was in the industry, we saw something that we numbers like 61 million tons of coal coming out of Illinois mines. A decade later, that being cut in half. What if you mentioned the different environmental regulations that have come into effect? How much has that different ways that we're looking at regulating the environment? How much is that of that has affected the coal industry?
Well, it's affected it a great deal because Illinois' coal is higher in sulfur than coal that comes from, in particular, the West, Wyoming's Powder River Basin. And the Clean Air Act of 1990, when they made some changes to that to deal with acid rain, which sulfur was a large contributor toward that problem. And that required power plants essentially to either install scrubbers to take the sulfur out of the exhaust or to burn coal from the West that did not have as much sulfur in it. And so when that happened, demand for Illinois coal just fell like a rock. And as you can see through the production numbers, they just they were cut in half over the course of a decade. And
so it costs more money then. It costs a lot more money to clean Illinois' coal. I imagine it's cheaper for us to get coal shipped in then from the West than it is to actually clean the coal that we have here?
Well, there's an argument over that because of, I mean, when you're bringing it in from the West, you're also paying for
transportation
costs.
And
so some of the Illinois mining interests will argue that, had Midwestern utilities sort of promptly installed scrubbers, there would have been no need for Western coal. And, obviously they decided otherwise.
Joan, in the article that you wrote in the Tribune, it came out earlier this week, and by the way, we'll tweet it out if you follow 21st Show, 21ST Show, to read all of John's reporting that he's done on this. You wrote about the upcoming election and how much that's expected to impact the coal industry, not just across the country, but also here in Illinois. So I wanted to just ask about our two presidential candidates and ask if you could summarize. First, let's start with Secretary Clinton. What's her stance on the coal industry? What has she said about it?
Well, the thing she has said that has essentially made her poison in southern Illinois and then probably all mining communities in the country is she made a statement at a town hall earlier this year that, we're going to put a lot of coal miners and coal companies out of business. And she was saying that as sort of a prelude to the various things that she was hoping to do to mitigate that damage in those communities. But it was the first part of that statement that everybody remembers.
Mm-hmm.
And should she be elected, the belief is down there in southern Illinois, she will continue with the Obama administration regulations, and particularly the Clean Power Plan, which is hung up in Supreme Court right now. And if she's able to name the ninth justice, that will probably give a majority to letting that plan go into effect. And when that happens, it's going to put much more pressure on utilities to move away from coal and thus put a lot more pressure on mines. Donald Trump, on the other hand, has made statements, sort of vague statements in support of returning to coal, although, he's not been very specific about how that's going to work. And as some people told me, there are a whole set of market forces that are really not under the president's control that are kind of pushing utilities to move away from coal, regardless of what happens in the White House. And yet, people that I spoke to still see a Trump presidency as really their last hope.
For the coal industry.
Right. They believe if Hillary Clinton wins, it's over.
And we're speaking to John Kalman. He's a Chicago Tribune reporter from one of their newsrooms in the suburbs, talking to us about the reporting he's done on coal mining. We got a question on Twitter from Paul about how many jobs are in the coal mining industry. Just to be clear, there's about 2,800 in Illinois right now, John?
Yeah, and that's going to drop by at least 300 here in the near future because a mine, the Petiki mine in Camry, Illinois, is going to be closing in November, they announced late last week.
And you, other analysts, as you mentioned this, you said coal is maybe, I don't know if they think the industry is too far gone for a political fix, but when you talk to coal miners across Illinois, are they holding out hope that they think maybe President Trump, a President Trump, would be someone who would be able to help the industry?
There are varying degrees of belief in that. I mean, some believe it's curtains, no matter who wins. And others think that, Donald Trump will indeed ratchet back some of these regulations and maybe do other things that will enable the industry to come back.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with John Kalman, a reporter with the Chicago Tribune. He's been writing about the upcoming election and the likely impacts on the coal industry in Illinois. We're going to continue this conversation with John. We're also going to speak to the president of a local United Mine Workers Association union in central Illinois. So stay tuned. You're listening to the 21st. As always, keep the tweets coming. 21st Show, 21ST Show. You can post on our Facebook page if you like us there. We always have a conversation going. You can give us a call, too, 1-800-222-9455. Again, 1-800-222-9455. Stay tuned. We'll continue this conversation in just a minute or two. Welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're talking about the state of the coal industry in Illinois and what the upcoming election, presidential election, would mean for the future of coal in the state. We've been speaking with John Kalman, a reporter for the Chicago Tribune. He's been speaking just from the newsroom in one of their newsrooms in the suburbs about this issue as he's been reporting on it. We are also joined now by Jody Hoag, a retired union coal miner and president of Local 9819, United Mine Workers of America. She's on the line with us now from Taylorville. Jody, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for taking the time to talk with us.
Thank you.
Like Randy, you used to work for Peabody, but Randy Phelps, who we spoke to earlier in the hour, you were in Kincaid near Springfield until your job was cut in 1991. When that happened, when those cuts happened back in the 90s, how was the area affected?
Well, the unemployment rate went really high, mm-hmm. and we lost money for the schools. We lost money for the roads. There was a lot of money because of the taxes that they was paying for that coal. We had a lot more money coming in. And after that, money pretty well, it hasn't recovered.
It hasn't. That's what I was going to ask you about. Because what economic recovery have you seen in the area? Where are people working?
Statistically, most of the jobs that are available now are in healthcare and technology. People would have to go back to school to get degrees to go into nursing or other healthcare fields or into technology.
And John, you wrote about this a little bit, about workers trying to retrain. I know that and when we were earlier in the hour talking about the cuts that have come this year, the hundreds of people that have been laid off in the industry this year, how many people, John, in your reporting did you find who were saying, I just need to retrain and just find a completely different industry?
Very few. Some of the folks I spoke with were able to get on at factories that were, an hour's drive away, that paid a lot less than they were making in the mines. To speak with one young man who decided to go back to school, and there was a federal program that really paid for almost all of it, and he is retraining to become a nurse because he saw that as a much more stable career path with the possibility, you know, down the road of at least approaching what he made in the mines, which is about $80,000 a year. That's pretty hard to come by most places, and really hard to come by down there where there's just not a lot going on economically.
Well, and Joan, you write about this across a couple towns, right? Because you wrote about the town of Harrisburg in Saline County, the mayor there telling you instead of waiting for the mines revival, he's trying to lure other businesses into the area. You talked about the town of Glacia. What are you seeing towns doing to try to, are there any towns you're seeing that are being maybe somewhat successful at trying to bring different businesses to the area?
In terms of being able to bring in businesses that pay what the coal mines pay, absolutely not. I mean, there really is nothing like that out there. Now, Harrisburg has been able to bring in some businesses. There was an assisted living home, movie theater, I think an auto parts store, things like that. But again, you know, that's not paying nearly what people were making in the mines. So, you know, as some other folks told me, I mean, if these towns are going to live, people are going to just have to, you know, accept that those high wage jobs are just not coming back and just do the best they can on the jobs that are available. And obviously, that's not a very appealing answer to a lot of people.
Yeah, Jody, and I think about as you sit here listening to this, I mean, you come from a family of miners. What was it about mining that attracted you to the job in the first place?
Well, I had several children, and the factory I worked at closed down and moved to a right-to-work state, and so there just wasn't anything here. And so that was the main reason, was because I knew I could get benefits and have a decent salary.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, as you think about all of this now, you know, do you see jobs in coal as part of Illinois' future, Jody? Would you like to see that?
I would like to see it, but I think as long as they're doing the fracking, and that's a very inexpensive way to get the natural gas. The coal companies they're not investing in new coal mines. And I don't think they will unless, God forbid, something, the fracking is going to cause problems with the water supplies. There's a lot of things that are not good about fracking. And as long as they're doing that and getting the natural gas so cheap, I just don't see coal coming back.
Mm-hmm. And you were saying, Jody, I know you were telling one of our producers earlier that when the mines were in Kincaid, where you worked in central Illinois, there was still a lot of coal left, but the state chose to ship in, or that mine particular, they chose to ship coal in from out west as opposed to keep mining what was left in that mine. Is that correct?
Yes. There was 30 or 40 more years of coal there, just in that area. I mean, you know, and that was just, you know, I'm not sure how big of an area, but it wasn't that big, but there were several years more. And when they decided not to scrub the Kincaid plant, we'd gotten legislation passed to scrub the Kincaid and the Baldwin plant, but when it got to the governor's desk, it wasn't something that they would allow them to. There was something that it wasn't a legal bill that they were trying to pass, or so this is what the governor said, and they left the part on that the consumers would pay for the transportation, which we didn't have transportation, nor did Baldwin. Our coal went across the road on a conveyor belt, and so did Baldwin's, but they left that part in so then they could bring it in from out west, and the consumers would pay for the cost of the transportation.
All right. Well, Jody, thank you so much for joining us, for filling us in a little bit about what's been going on in Taylorville. That's Jody Hoag, retired union coal miner. She's president of Local 8919, United Mine Workers of America. I want to thank also John Kileman, a reporter for the Chicago Tribune, who joined us to talk about the reporting he's been doing on this issue as well. Jody, John, thanks for being with me.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Look outside that window. It's not a bird or a plane, but a window washer dressed up as Spider-Man. Well, that's a sight that greeted young patients inside the Ann and Robert H. Lurie Children's Hospital in Chicago on Monday. The patients were treated to a group of window washers from a company, Service One, who showed up to clean the hospital's windows with their washers in full superhero garb. We're joined now by one of those superhero window washers. Cruz Guzman is on the line with us from Chicago. Cruz, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, no, thank you. It's my pleasure to be on.
I imagine, I imagine it's not in your normal job description to dress up as a superhero when you're washing windows on Chicago buildings, so it might have been a little weird. But once you saw the kids at the hospital, what happened?
So, you know, it's, I think it's like every kid's dream to be a superhero, and not only were we, I was able to dress up as one, but, you know, got to play with the kids and get to see their awesome reaction. And, you know, you could hear them through the glass screaming, enjoying, you know, asking us to, you know, swing around, do a couple of flips. And, you know, it's something that kept me up all night, you know, wanting to go and share this moment with the kids.
Were you nervous before? Did you think, because I think normally window washing is kind of it's a pretty anonymous job, right? You're kind of out there cleaning windows. I don't know if you normally have interaction with people when you're washing windows on the side of a building.
Well, I mean, we got to respect that. It's, a lot of the times we're working in condos, so we got to respect
that
it's their house.
So, their privacy. So you're definitely probably trying to not interact with people, right?
Exactly. So you just get the window done and just move on to the next floor. But here at the hospital, you know, the kids are, you know, they're a little bit aware of that we're going to be dressed up and we're going to be, you know, be on the side of the building. So they're actually looking for us. And when we get to the floor and we get to see kids, you know, instead of just washing the window and going on to the next, we stay there a little bit and, you know, try to cheer them up. You know, that's our main goal. It's not just like showing up to go to work, but doing a little bit of extra, and which is, you know, getting a smile from the kid.
So, Cruz, how high up are you when we're washing the windows at the hospital?
So this building, it's close to 24 floors. So I want to, it's a little bit taller than usual, so it could be between 350 feet and 400 feet.
So you're not nervous about being what I like about this, you're not nervous about being so high above the ground, but what kept you up all night was being dressed up as a superhero and kind of maybe window washing and being a superhero for the kids?
Oh, yeah. Honestly, that's the truth. I couldn't sleep at night the night before because I want to make sure that the kids, you know, they didn't just see just a window washer that they saw, that they actually felt that was the superhero, and I wanted them to enjoy it. So, you know, all night I was thinking, what are ways, what could I do to make it seem like, you know, that I'm actually Spider-Man?
Yeah, did you practice? What did you?
Well, I just ran some ideas through my head, and, you know, the first thing was obviously, you know, safety first, but other than that, you know, I was able to do a couple backflips, swing around, you know, grab onto the glass like if I was actually...
Oh, put your hands up? Did you put your hands up like you were Spider-Man on the glass? And how did the kids react? So did the kids come up to the window? Could you hear them? I'm sure you heard them screaming, you said, but what other kind of things did they do?
So there was this kid that actually... So he was on his room by himself, and I had a pleasure with him. It was like close to like 15 minutes I was there with him. And he was dressed up as Spider-Man as well, and he had little action figures. And... you know, he was basically doing like the little hand gesture that Spider-Man does when the web comes out. And, you know, I was singing around and I was doing the same hand gesture, making it seem like, you know, I had the web coming out. And so basically he had his little action figures and he'll put them up against the window and, you know, he'll make me fist bump them. It was something special with him.
Yeah.
And you know, it's stuff like, you know, I could literally... you hear them screaming, and you know these windows are pretty thick, so it's hard to, you know, be able to hear stuff. But I could hear him screaming. I could see his smile, his reaction, just pretty much said at all.
Do you think he thought you were really Spider-Man? I don't know if the kids, some of the kids maybe thought that.
Well, I honestly think that, like, the smaller kids, you know, they're a little bit more innocent. I think they actually thought we were, you know, the superheroes, just the way they acted around us. Because we went inside the building for a little bit, and we were able to talk to a few of them. And obviously, the bigger kids, they know that superheroes don't wash windows, but actually save people here and there.
Right. Now, I know that after you climbed the walls outside, did you get a chance to go into the hospital and also meet with the kids?
Yeah, we went to the 18th floor. I think that's, I'm not sure what's there, but there's a large group of kids there. And, we were lucky enough that they had confidence in us to let us pick up, like, the smaller kids and take pictures with them and their family. And so we got to hear a little bit of their little background. And, well, most importantly, you know, we told them, you know, stay strong and believe in themselves, and, you know, that we're not the superheroes, that they are. They're the ones that, you know, that proving to the world that they're tougher than Spider-Man, Batman, or Iron Man.
I'm talking to Cruz Guzman. He works for Service One. They're a window washing company, and on Monday they had their workers dress up as superheroes to wash the windows at Lurie Children's Hospital in Chicago. And Cruz, do you have kids?
I have two girls. One is 3-year-old, and my youngest one is just actually turned one.
Oh, well, congratulations. So I imagine as a father, it must have been an extra layer of emotion for you to be in the hospital, seeing these kids who obviously are there because they have different illnesses or different things that they're being treated for.
Oh, yeah, especially, my daughter, she's, you know, at the stage where she watches TV and she pays attention to what's out there. And when she sees, like, action figures, toys, she gets excited. And she was able to see a picture of me as Spider-Man. And I actually even took the mask so she could see it. Jesus, she couldn't stop laughing. Or I think it was, like, the nervous laugh that
she was like, why is Daddy dressed up like Spider-Man? Mm-hmm. Sure.
Basically. And, you know, it gets emotional because, you know, you see your kids at home, they're running around laughing, and then we come here and there's a couple kids, you know, they're real sick. But for a brief moment, you could tell that they enjoy seeing us out there.
Yeah. So I guess is it back to your, how often do you guys do this? Do you do this once a year when you're cleaning the windows, or how often do you get to do this with the hospital?
So this was actually Service One's first time to be on the outside of the building dressed up, but from my understanding, I think it should be 3 times a year that we're going to be out there dressed up as superheroes.
All right. Are you going to be Spider-Man next time also?
Oh, you know, we might flip a coin, see who gets who, but hopefully I'm Spider-Man. I love Spider-Man.
All right. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to join us and share with us about your experience. We tweeted out pictures, by the way, of Cruz and the other guys dressed up as superheroes when washing the windows at Lurie Children's Hospital. Cruz, thanks for being with us.
Oh, thank you. It's my pleasure. I appreciate it.
I mentioned we tweeted those out. You can always find us on social media. Our handle is 21st Show. On Facebook, you can search for the 21st. All of the information on how to contact us is at our website at www.21stshow.org. That's where all of our social accounts are. It's also got our email and voicemail if you want to give us feedback and leave us a message. We'd love to hear about that, too. So head to www.21stshow.org for that. Stay tuned. You're listening to the 21st. Coming up, we're going to be talking to the band, the Poster Children. They've reunited after some time apart for a concert tonight in Champaign at the Pygmalion Festival. So that's coming up. Stay tuned. You're listening to the 21st. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. That's a little bit of He's My Star, one of the most popular songs from the indie band, The Poster Children. They toured the country all through the 90s and early 2000s, and they've reunited for the Pygmalion Festival. They're playing tonight at the outdoor stage at the Accord in Champaign. They're also back to celebrate the 25th anniversary of their album, Daisy Chain Reaction. Two of their members, Rick Valentin and Rose Marshak, are here with me in studio. Welcome to The 21st, Rose. Rick, thanks for being with us.
Hi. Thanks for having us.
So when Poster Children played on and off throughout the 2000s, first of all, is it fair to call this a reunion for you guys?
Yeah, I know. I had thoughts about it. We always said, oh, we're never going to break up. We're never going to have a reunion. But
We haven't played together for how many years? Eight, 9 years.
So, 8, 9 years.
Yeah. So okay. It's definitely a reunion, but we didn't break up either.
Okay. And so you guys started actually on the campus at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. At the time, you guys had a label deal. You were touring all around the country. When did you decide to stop touring? How did that kind of, as you said, you guys never broke apart.
No, wait a minute. Yeah. Now, we started in Allen Hall, and we were playing, we played for like 4 or 5 years.
4 or 5 years before we had a big record deal. But we started out on indie labels and then moved to major labels. But what made us stop? I mean, it's a little unfair, but I think we had kids. And even though we're very DIY and very organized, kind of on top of it people, I think that was the big thing was like, and some bands we knew took their kids on the road. But for us, it was just like, I think we've been doing this for a while. We can stay at home for a while, take care of the kids, pursue other things. And that's kind of what we did.
What's it like to be back here, to be back on campus?
I come back here all the time.
Do you?
I'm here
okay.
at least a couple of times a week. Our children take violin lessons here at the conservatory, and I'm here all the time for capoeira. So I'm here all the time. It's always interesting to come back to campus and see the changes.
Yeah, because we lived here for, 25 or 30 years?
We lived here for, about 30 years. And I feel like this is home, and it's weird to be away sometimes.
But when we first came here, there were only pizza places. Like
We
recorded our first tape when the first Mexican food place showed up in town. I remember
that's
that.
That's right.
How do you think the music scene has changed since then, too?
I tell people now that I have a perspective of 30 years.
that's why I'm asking.
Now you should listen to him.
And so, when we were kind of really active, it seemed like this was the moment and great things were happening. There were a lot of great bands in town and they were touring around and everything like that. But things kind of seemed to take a dip. And then they came up
it
again.
It ebbs and flows.
And it ebbs and flows.
But we were really I always tell my music business students this. We would go around the United States and we'd go in Europe and people would interview us and they'd say, what's the Champagne scene like? And we'd say, oh my goodness, it's incredible. You should hear these amazing bands. There's Hum, there's Braid, there's The Digits, there's Lonely Trailers, incredible bands. It's the most fantastic place. And, when other people, Champagne scene is fantastic. So then when other Champagne bands would go through those towns, people would go, oh, I heard your scene is fantastic. And it's great.
So you guys did a good job promoting the
scene here has always been really supportive.
But that's the thing is, so we've been in a couple of like talks and things like that with people from the scene in the 60s and the 70s. And you start realizing, wow, the same kind of things were happening here a long time ago also, like before our time and then after our time, right? And so you realize there's something special about Champagne.
What is the culture? Do you think it's because it's a college town? There's always going to be, you have kind of a group of a population of students who maybe are there's so many students, there's always going to be some who always are looking for live music or indie music or that scene. Is that part of it?
Yeah, I definitely think that's it. And you see that in a lot of college towns. But then the question is always, well, why didn't this town become Athens, Georgia, for instance? And it's because, well...
Or Seattle, right?
And so Athens, Georgia had the B-52s and REM, right? And so those bands got so huge that I think maybe it... And people from Athens, Georgia would kill me for saying this.
And the Indigo Girls from Athens?
Yeah, maybe, yeah.
Yeah, I think they are.
Sometimes if a band gets too big, it kind of blows up the scene to the point where everyone thinks, we're going to be the next REM or something. And so in some ways, the lack of that, I mean, there have been lots of great bands. Well, REO Speedwagon came from Champaign, right?
That's right, yeah.
People don't think of them as a Champaign band. And so I think it's just that it has that vital atmosphere, but in some ways, because no one's become sort of specifically identified with the town that it's been able to rejuvenate and continue to have the real vitality.
But wait a minute. There are other... So this town does not only spawn like bands and a music scene. There's so many other fantastic things about what happens around the university too, you know? So then that's why, you know, there's all the computer science stuff that goes on here. And everything else. It's a fantastic town. So, and that's why I'm like really proud of the Pygmalion Festival, you know, because Seth highlights not only music, but there's literary fest now and there's tech and all that stuff. And I think that maybe, you know, that's I think that's the most fantastic thing about the Pygmalion Festival. Sorry to
Why you guys is it the Pygmalion Festival? Is that what has finally, after 8 or 9 years, you guys were like, okay, if we're going to come back together, we're going to do this and play for Pygmalion Festival?
I think it was a combination of things.
We've been invited a couple of times, and it's not. The kids are too young yet, you know. But this year
it all kind of just fell together, where it was like, oh, Pygmalion, the 25th anniversary of the record, and we were all starting to have some breathing room again in our lives a little bit, not a lot, but a little bit, you know. And so it was like, oh, it all kind of fell together into place.
So that's the 25th anniversary of Daisy Chain Reaction. We're speaking to Rick Valentin and Rose Marshak of Poster Children. Let's take a listen to, I thought we could listen to If You See K, which is off the 1991 record.
If we
Daisy
can.
Chan. Yeah, let's listen to it. That's If You See K off the 1991 record Daisy Chain Reaction. The band is Poster Children. They're back together. They're reunited for the first time in about 9 years. They're going to be playing tonight at the Pygmalion Festival. Two of the band members, Rick Valentin and Rose Marshak, are in studio with me. Tell our audience, you know, you're both faculty, you're both professors at Illinois State University. You're married. You guys have kids. How do your kids feel about this shit? How do the kids feel about, hey, mom and dad are going to be, or have they seen you play?
Our oldest has. I don't know if our youngest has seen
us
play.
I don't think he's seen us.
Yeah, no, because he's seven and we haven't played together. Yeah, so I don't even know if he saw us rehearse. I guess he heard a little bit of it the other day.
His second grade classroom, their theme is rock stars and rock bands.
So their parents are actually rock stars.
Yeah, but
everybody's
a rock star. So he comes home and he's a member of the band, and we have to sign something because he did good.
The tour manager has given him.
Yes,
I can't remember. Yeah, it's the theme of his whole class is based around
signed,
rock and roll.
Signed the band manager. You know, everything is signed from his teacher, who's the band manager. So it hits a little too close to home. So
have you talked to them about your experience? Touring,
not
all of that.
Not yet. So he came home and Alex Fisher, who's going to be helping us, who's going to be playing tonight, said to him, "Did you tell your teacher that your parents are rock stars?" And he said, "Oh yes, I did." And I'm like,
did she believe him?
Well, everybody's a rock star. Every time you do something good, you're a rock star. Right?
We had a whole conversation about it. It's a very strange thing, you know, thinking about when we started out, that idea. Well, and actually, because we're kind of from a punk rock, indie rock background, rockstar was actually kind of a derogatory
right,
term.
Kind of pejorative, right? Yeah. You didn't want to be a rock star.
Yeah, exactly. And that kind of our whole scene was about rejecting that. And so now it's very strange that it's gotten to a point where it's just kind of this generic thing. It's not even controversial or anything like that. It's just this kind of fun label.
It's nice word that makes people feel good about themselves.
Exactly.
Which is a little bit different than you guys thought. Yeah. Are your kids picking up instruments? Are they playing? You said one of your children plays the violin.
Both of them play violin. They started when they were four. I know it seems like a punk rock band. You know, we'd be buying them pointy little guitars and stuff. But no, they're starting just like I did, classically. And I feel like that's really important to instill that type of
is that
music
how you
background.
Did you start with classical music background?
Yeah, I did. Although you didn't, right?
I didn't. No, not at all. I'm kind of a classic rock and roll kind of.
Yeah, but
history.
You played a clarinet and you played stuff too.
Saxophone.
Yeah.
Please.
Same
I did not
thing.
Play the clarinet.
String.
So
I'm a violinist.
Are you guys
so.
what can everyone expect from tonight? Are you guys ready to I don't want to say rock again, right?
Yeah.
Because I don't want to.
Lots of saxophone and violin. No. Yeah. It is good. I mean, even though we're getting on in years, no. It's actually quite loud and still rocking, and our drummer is younger than us, and really, honestly, that's the most important part. As long as the drummer can keep up, the guitar player, the bass players, the singers, you know, that's a little easier. And so
we're gonna jump around on stage like crazy people. I mean, that's what we.
And are your children gonna be there too?
I don't know if they'll notice that we're doing that, because they may have little, you know, phones.
Or they
to
might
look
be
at
the maker table, right? They're going to have
true.
All sorts
yeah,
of computer
fest.
Stuff and everything.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's the thing is that they're.
Oh, mommy
in
and
lots
daddy are yelling and playing music again.
Yeah. Well, thanks for coming from Bloomington to join us here in studio in Urbana. Rick Valentin, Rose Marshak, Poster Children are playing. They're playing tonight at the outdoor stage at the Accord in Champaign, 8:15 for the Pygmalion Festival. I thought we would end on a song from your 1995 album, Junior Citizen. We played a little bit to start, but this is Here's My Star. Thanks for being with me. We're produced by Christine Herman, Philip Kisabika, and Sean Newman. Technical direction comes from Jason Croft with help from Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our news director. Thanks to Joe Yoon and Nick Vance from the University of Illinois Social Media Analytics Lab for their research help. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. Savior in a brand new car, shining like a star.